At 17, Chantelle McDougall was nannying for a 36-year-old man. At 20, she was pregnant with his child and swept up in his bizarre spiritual beliefs. At 27, they all disappeared.
I just wished I'd asked a lot more questions no matter what.
I'm Dominique Bayens, host of Expanse, The Nan Up 4, a story of control, manipulation and isolation. Search Expanse on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
Kate McClymont's career as an investigative journalist has exposed a litany of wrongdoing from politicians, union officials, property developers, sporting organisations and media personalities. Kate's stories have initiated many police cases and prison sentences and won her 10 Walkley Awards so far. Her uncovering of corruption and criminality has also made Kate many enemies, who've reacted with a steady stream of abuse over Kate's hygiene and clothing, along with serious threats to her life. But for Kate, that kind of intimidation has only made her even more determined. Hi, Kate.
Thank you, Sarah. I'd like to just say my hygiene, it's not that bad.
As far as I can tell from our interaction, it's absolutely
excellent.
All above board.
I'm glad to hear that.
When you cold call someone about a story, how do you approach that first conversation?
It depends on why I'm calling them. So if I am calling somebody that I want to help me, I say that first up. Because, you know, you say, oh, it's Kate McClymont here, and you can hear people go, aah. So I say, oh, look, you know, it's Kate McClymont here. I'm really hoping that you may be able to help me. And then people relax into, oh, great, great. She's not after me. She's just calling for information. But for the people that I am after, I usually just, look, you dread those kind of conversations, but you just ring up and say, look, you know, no doubt you know why I'm calling, because usually they do by that stage. If you haven't already got a legal threat, you know that they know. So you just say, look, I'm ringing because of, you know, this. And the other day I rang somebody and then I sent them a text message, and the person rang back and said, oh, my God, I'm so thrilled to get a call from you. This is not the number of the person that you were calling, but, oh, my goodness, am I pleased to speak to you. I said, oh, look, that's so nice. I'm sorry you're not the person I've been chasing.
When you're trying to fish for information, maybe if someone who's not familiar with you or aware of why you might be calling, I mean, you're having to bluff as well. Is that part of your suite of skills, is working out what to reveal that you know, what not to say?
Look, I think part of your job is being an amateur psychologist. So the phone call is so important. So you are trying to work out just over the phone what method is going to work. You know, do you ask them, you know, hope you don't mind if I'm ringing, or I'm sorry to call you on a weekend. You try to at least sound human, approachable, understanding. And if that doesn't work, like I had a call yesterday where somebody was, you know, going off at me, and I said, look, I'm sorry. Were you in the interview with that person or was I? I think I did the interview and you're wrong.
So sometimes it's just a firm line.
Sometimes you just have to say, look, no, you've got the wrong end of the stick here. That is not how you are imagining it.
You're a keen bridge player, Kate. Is there a crossover between the game of bridge and these kind of interactions?
Oh, well, look, I've got some very good stories from some of my my bridge partners. But, look, I think bridge is a game of strategy, memory, bit of bluffing. So maybe they are involved. You have done your research.
I'd be quite terrified sitting across from you at a bridge table.
No, no.
That's what you would say, wouldn't it? No. How important is the public to the work that you do? I mean, how regularly are you contacted out of the blue with a tip-off?
I was going to say, unfortunately, too many times, and I don't mean that, but I just mean that I often feel I'm letting people down because I get so many calls, emails, please can you help me, my husband is about to take my child. And I just have to say, I'm so sorry, but that's not my field. And also, if it's family court, we can't do that. But also, I'm in a retirement home. These things are happening. And of course, you know, you want to be able to assist, but the reality is there are not enough hours in the day to do all the things that need doing. And I get them from all over Australia. And I have to say, look, unfortunately, we are the Sydney Morning Herald. So it's unlikely that we'll look at a story, you know, in Townsville or Geelong or somewhere like that.
How quickly are you able now to kind of spot if this is a story that might have legs for you?
Pretty quickly, but you're not always right on things. And sometimes people who are distressed and a little bit all over the shop and are not actually making a lot of sense, if you give them a call and say, now slow down. Now, if you were just to tell me in one sentence, like get to the nub of what it is. And the next thing that you look for is it provable? Is, you know, do you have any documents? But I find some of my best stories have come from members of the public just ringing up. And one of my all-time favourite calls was from a parent at a school, at a private school, saying, I want you to look into this guy called Michael Williamson. He's the head of the Health Services Union. And I said, oh, look, I actually haven't heard of him. And he said, oh, he's also the president of the ALP. And this person said, he and his wife drive top-of-the-range Mercedes-Benz. They travel first class. They've got five kids at private school. His wife doesn't work. But the ultimate insult for this man was that he kept outbidding them at the school charity auction. That was his bugbear. And
something was up.
Something was up. But as a result of my investigation, that guy went to jail for 5 years. He'd been milking the union, you know, stealing millions. But that was just from a parent at the school saying, why don't you have a look at this guy? So, and people stop me in the dog park and tell you things. So, look, the tips are often very good.
And so when you do get a tip that you think is worth following, you want to sniff into it a bit further, where do you start? What's usually
look,
your
first,
approach?
For instance, with Michael Williamson, the first thing that you do is you do what's called an ASIC search, and that's a search with the corporate watchdog to see what companies is somebody in. That will give you a birth date, date of birth. It'll also give you who are the fellow directors. You know, where was the company located? Where was their principal place of business? So you do that and then
And what are the red flags when you're looking at that?
The red flags are, have there been administrators appointed? Just for instance, looking at that Michael Williamson, I get the call, I do my ASIC search. I find that Michael Williamson has a company, say it was called Williamson Global IT. Then I go to the annual report of the union and I start going through and I find that Williamson Global IT has a $1 million contract to provide IT services to the union. I soon find out no such services are provided. And also, you know, if you're around long enough, you know there are things like if a director has business interests, you have to disclose third-party interests in an annual report. Then I find that the union owns a property, you know, down near the airport. And guess who runs their recording studio from the union-owned property? Michael Williamson's son. So, you know, you start doing property searches. Then I find out that the union architect is doing all the work on his holiday home, on his home. So it was one of those things that it didn't actually take a long time to realise we were absolutely onto something here.
So there's all those financial pieces that might go into story. What about the police? What's your relationship with the police when you're following a story?
Look, it's mixed. The police try to do their own thing. And look, it depends on the nature of the story. Like sometimes people will come to you as opposed to going to the police. And as well as being a journalist, we, you know, I am also a citizen. So I will often say to these people, look, I think that this is serious enough that I think you should go to the police. At the moment, you are a confidential source of mine, so I can make the introduction, but maybe that's something that you should think about. So you do try to do your job as a journalist, but also we are citizens.
You must have built good relationships with individual officers over your decades doing this kind of work.
Look, I think it is mutual trust. And if a police officer rang me up and said, we are on the verge of making all these arrests, if you tip these people off, they're likely to do such and such. So you do try to talk your way around those kind of issues. But, I mean, the last thing that you want to do is interfere with a major police investigation. So it's a question of balance, really.
And it's not just paper trail investigating that you do. You're also out on the streets on stakeouts. How do you prepare for one of those? Like, do you have a go-to costume, Kate?
look, it depends where it is, but I often take the I've got two dogs, and I often take the dogs, and people just think that you're a dog walker. So you do that. But unfortunately, I think that my face is now a bit better known than it was.
For them, it's a red flag if you're outside walking your dogs.
In fact, I met somebody who was a confidential source, and I said, we're going to go to this cafe. No one ever goes there, and, you know, because I don't want them to for us to be seen. And we get down, and these two women come over and went, Kate McClymont! Oh, and I said, oh, this is meant to be a secret meeting.
You're going to have to get, funny moustache or something.
Oh, I know. But look, that's fine. Like, people are normally very nice.
And as you're putting a story together, when you've got all of these different parts, what's your method for keeping all those details together in your mind? I mean, you might be tracking things over decades, lots of different people. Do you have a cork board? What's it look like?
I have had the big white paper with the pens, but our offices aren't big enough anymore. So, look, funnily enough, a timeline. Like, one of the first things I ever do with an investigation is start a timeline. With Eddie Obeid, the former New South Wales politician, it was about 200 pages long because I kept adding. But it helps you keep things in your mind, and it also shows up patterns. Like, you'll see that on such and such a date, a donation was made, and then you'll see 4 days later, a local government gave approval for a building to go ahead. So you look at the quid pro quos, you look at this thing happens, and then, oh my goodness, look what happens just days down the track. So it's a simple thing, but it is. And I tell young journalists all the time, start a timeline.
And after all that hard work that might be months, even years, in the sort of reporting that you do, what's your state of mind the night before a story is published?
Sick. Absolutely sick. I think people sort of don't quite understand that the anxiety. Like, not only are you writing something that's going to have possibly a terrible impact on the life of the person you are writing about, so you have a duty to make sure it is all correct. And also with defamation laws, the stakes are incredibly high. So it's more you're just riddled with anxiety that you have done everything that you can do to make sure it's accurate, it's true.
Did your parents read newspapers when you were a kid growing up? What do you remember about that?
Oh, my parents, the 7 o'clock ABC News was on every single night. I grew up on a farm outside of Orange. I can remember, you know, I think it was called the Farm Hour or the Country Hour. Country Hour.
Still on ABC?
Still on the ABC. And, yes, we got the Sydney Morning Herald and the Central Western Daily. every day. So my parents were very big consumers of news, and they were interested in, you know, the goings on of life, really.
Your dad used to read the newspaper with a cockatoo. Is that true? Tell me about that.
Oh, yes. So my father was a little bit of an eccentric, and he had a cockatoo, and every night he would be reading my mother bits of the newspaper while the cockatoo sat on one shoulder, and he'd be sipping his whiskey and occasionally, this is gross, giving the cockatoo a sip of his whiskey. So it was, yes, it was quite a sight. And they would go out together and the cockatoo would sit on his shoulder. They'd go on the motorbike. It was...
Could it talk, this cockatoo, or it just sipped whiskey?
Yes, and... no, it could talk. It used to say, oh, you're a silly bugger. Oh, that was one of its common things was, oh, you're a silly bugger.
Was that something your dad would say?
Yes.
Was that one of his
phrases?
Yes,
religiously, yes.
Applicable in so many situations. What kind of jobs did you have to do on the farm as a kid? Farm kids always have to do a lot.
Well, my father was a veterinary surgeon and my mother was a pharmacist. But my father only practiced for a couple of weeks before he took over the property. So he used to make us assist him with his sort of, I don't know, operations and things like that because we had small fingers. I can remember when cattle got bloat, you had to stab them to let out, like, because they would die. And you had to then sew up, I think it was the stomach wall, but he would make us do it.
And with your little childlike
hands. With our little childlike hands and our neat sewing. And we had to help, you know, deliver calves and, you know, feed the chickens, do all those kind of things that you do on a farm.
And were you and your sister given different kinds of jobs than your brothers?
Look, you know, when you were just saying then about the newspaper, so my mother had a full-time job and she would come home and there would be my father reading the newspaper, talking to her while she then turned around and cooked dinner after working as well.
I think it's
and
called the second shift, isn't it?
Correct. And I remember that for a while we were doing the same thing and then my sister and I said, oh, well, hang on, look, this isn't fair. Why? We're doing all the outside work as well as doing this. And my mother said, you are absolutely right. So things did start to change.
And did you carry that independence of mind into the classroom, Kate?
look, I was one of those children that I was regarded as the class comedian. And every year I would try to get off on a new footing and not crack jokes or make, you know, wisecracks from the back of the room. And then it was funny, in sixth class, is at Orange Public School, I had one of those teachers that was changed my life. Like, his name was Ron Sinclair, and he recently wrote a letter to the Herald about how proud he was of his student because I was the, you know, the ducks of the school. But only because he was one of those teachers that got you. And you just have to thank your lucky stars to have come across just one person who was inspirational, fantastic, fostered a love of learning, fostered a genuine, he was just inspiring. Look, I'm getting teary even thinking about Ron Sinclair and the effect that he had on my life.
Have you seen him since?
No, but I've seen the letters. Like, he writes a letter to the Herald. He's a prolific writer to the Herald. But, you know, he himself was a Fairbridge farm boy, which was a school outside of Orange that has been exposed by people like the former head of the ABC. David Hill and his twin brother went to that school and it was, you know, little kids from the UK being sent to what their parents were told was a better life, but it was sexual abuse. It was like modern day slavery. And Ron Sinclair had come from that. Like, wow.
You yourself, Kate, have had some great losses in your family, including the drowning of your brother when you were just children. How did that tragedy shape you, do you think, looking back?
Look, it's, I think until you live through that and you see the impact upon your parents and on the family, nothing can ever prepare you for the complete change in the life as you knew it. And then later on, both my parents were killed in a car accident. It still upsets me. But the thing is, I sort of think that it's given me the realization that bad things happen. It's unfair. It's like you'd think, having lived through one tragedy, you wouldn't have to go through a second one. But it also makes you realize that this is life. This is what life deals you. And when people say, oh, do you worry about threats? Do you worry if people will kill you? And I think, no, I actually don't. Because if somebody wanted to kill you, they would. And there is almost nothing you could do about it. So I think tragedy and knowing that you are not immune from it means that you cannot let it dictate your life or ruin your life. You have to seize whatever you have and do your best.
There can be a kind of fearlessness that people develop after facing horrible losses like that, because it's like, well, the worst almost has happened. What can life throw at me that I haven't faced already and endured?
That's true. Although I must say that my children are now grown up, but it did worry me. You know, it's all very well being brave for yourself, but I sometimes worried that my activities would lead to harm to my family. And now that that's sort of passed, it's sort of, maybe it's liberating in a way, being free of the fear for what could happen to them. But, and look, despite those things happening to me, I'm a fairly optimistic person. I sort of tend to look on the bright side. Like, people say, oh, don't all these people get you down? And I say, oh, no, not in the slightest.
Well, you studied English literature at university. You're a great reader. And I wonder if it's those great novels can sort of help make sense of lives and loss and gain and fate and meaning. I mean, they kind of can give a different structure to experience. I think that's one of the things we turn to fiction for.
Oh, look, I think absolutely. And every couple of years I reread George Eliot's Middlemarch, which I just think is just one of the most perfect books. But there are, and I think maybe that's why I stuck with journalism, because when I read, you know, like just the most beautiful turns of phrase, I just think, oh, gee, I wish I could have done that, but I can do something else.
I can do Eddie O'Bee. I can't do Middlemarch.
I can't do Helen Garner. I can't do Helen Garner. I can't do, but I guess I can do straightforward things.
So when you were studying at university, Kate, you came up with a very innovative way of making money. Can you tell me about your booth in King's Cross?
Well, as I was sort of implying, I don't have a great deal of either musical talent, none of those kind of things, but I can talk. So I had a busking booth, and it was questions answered 40 cents, arguments 50 cents, and verbal abuse $1. And look, in those days, King's Cross was sort of the risky centre of Sydney nightlife, and people would walk up and down just looking for something to happen. So if you were there, people would stop and they would pay you money. And
so you had a sign up behind
you? Yes, I had a sign behind me, you know, advertising my wares. But I quickly realised the value of upselling. Like, if someone wanted to pay 40 cents for questions answered and they didn't agree with your answer, you could say, well, you could pay 50 cents and we'll argue about it. But the thing that always stunned me was the amount of young men who would pay a dollar and then say, could you please abuse my girlfriend?
What?
I know. And you would say to the girlfriend, what kind of loser are you to have a boyfriend who would give me a dollar
to abuse you? Like, what are you doing?
It's a fail-proof business scheme that you developed.
Absolutely.
So you made good money?
Look, I made $17 an hour, which in those days, and we're talking about a long time ago.
It's more than my teenager is getting at McDonald's
exactly.
right now.
It was, and the thing was, you could do it. You didn't have to do it every single week. It wasn't a must-do, but then people would say, oh, where have you been? And they'd ask you all sorts of things like, you know, did I have any tips for the races on Saturday?
You were like an oracle with your booth. And what would you say if someone asked for that?
Oh, you'd make something up or, you know, maybe you did know something and you'd say, oh, well, you know, no, I didn't really know the answer. But if they wanted to argue about it, you could just charge them more, really.
I think of all these skills that you were developing doing that, Kate, of quick thinking and logical argument. And
I know, but the funny thing was I think that is what got me my later cadetship at the Sydney Morning Herald because, you know, I'd done an honours degree in literature. I'd worked at newspaper. I had a radio show, you know, on public radio. I'd done all those things, but they were far more interested in my busking than anything else.
You've really spent your whole career at Fairfax, now Nine, apart from a couple of years at the ABC with Four Corners. What was it like in the office at Four Corners when you began?
I remember when I arrived at Four Corners, within a couple of weeks, Chris Masters' seminal program, The Moonlight State, on police and political corruption in Queensland went to air, and I literally thought that I'd died and gone to heaven, that I was working for this program that did stories as important and risky and so well researched as that program. But it also taught me other things. You know, I was chatting to Chris Masters the other day and he reminded me that program kept him in courts with defamation actions for 10 years. And he said, you know, it was death by a thousand courts. And you do realise that that kind of journalist, you pay a price for doing it.
And you couldn't do it without the support of an organisation, I think,
absolutely
just when you say
not.
It like that.
No, and I think, you know, like I love the idea of citizen journalism, but you need the backing of a major organisation. Like just getting a silk, like a senior barrister for one day is $10,000. So you can imagine trying to run a court case with a whole legal team. Who is going to have those kind of resources? And even doing things like doing ASIC searches, they are not cheap. So investigative journalism is quite a costly exercise, both legally and just in the use of resources and also just in a journalist's time, like the amount of time it takes to get that story over the line.
You then went on to break so many stories yourself as a journalist over your career. And I want to ask you about a fairly recent story. How did you first come across a woman named Melissa Caddick?
Again, life throws up the most serendipitous moments. So I was looking at a businessman who was accused of insider trading and ASIC, the corporate watchdog, had executed search warrants, but they can't execute themselves. They have to get the federal police to do it on their behalf. So I rang up ASIC and said, can you tell me about the search warrants issued at this person? And they said, you can't tell you anything. So I rang up the federal police and they said, on the Wednesday, yep. Now, are you talking about the raids we did at Walleroy Road or at Wollangra Road? And I said, well, I'm looking at the first, but I said, who's at the second? That would be a woman called Melissa Caddick. So I then thought, oh, okay. So, you know, you just Google, there's nothing on Melissa Caddick. In fact, the last thing Melissa Caddick, financial advisor, had done was some years ago she'd been interviewed and she gave tips on how to spot a fraudulent financial advisor and all the tips she gave were about herself. Please check that they have the appropriate academic qualifications. She'd made hers up. Please check that they have an AFSL license. She was using someone else's. And if people had only taken her guide for how to spot a dodgy operative. Anyway, so I started looking, you know, I did
my... But you just Google this and you think, oh...
I just thought, what? Why are they doing searches? Mm. Like, I can't find... She's not a major player. I do the ASIC searches. I see she has a personal company called Malavar. She's running a financial business at her own home. But there's nothing. Like, you think, what? Nothing. And then she goes missing. So it's like, right, okay, now there is something really wrong here. And I remember watching her husband, Anthony Coletti, at the press conference to say that his wife was missing. And I just thought, your demeanour is weird. Here you are saying, Melissa, come home. You're not in any trouble. We love you. And I think that by this time I'd realised they'd been at her house for an entire day. She had got up the next morning, supposedly at around 5:30. She'd left her keys. She'd left her phone. She had disappeared. Does her husband ring the police and say, oh, my wife has gone missing? No, he waits 30 hours, 30 hours to report his wife, who is the subject of a major investigation, that she has gone missing. And when he finally does report this to the police, he says he's too busy to come down and give a statement. Now, look, all of this was suspicious, but Anthony Coletti had nothing to do with his wife's disappearance. He's just an unusual person who'd made some unusual decisions. But I then spoke to somebody who'd had the most fortuitous thing happen to her, in that she had, and we have to think back to, this is 2020, it's COVID. So this woman had gone to have root canal therapy, of all dreadful things. So she's in town, she's waiting to see the dentist. There's one other patient in the waiting room. They get chatting and they're talking about the eeriness of the streets being empty, that there's no one there. And this woman says, well, look, I'm actually really lucky because I run a financial advisory service, but we've been able to do it from home. And the other woman says, oh, my financial advisor, she runs her business from home in Dover Heights. There's dead silence. And the other woman said, okay, is it Melissa Caddick? She said, yes. She said, you need to contact me as soon as you get out of your
root
procedure.
Canal surgery.
So they spoke that afternoon and she said, you need to get your money out. She's been using my license without my permission, and I think basically reported her to the authorities. So that woman was able to get, she had $2 million with Melissa Caddick and she'd had it out.
And then she called you, the woman.
So I'd written a story about this missing woman. And see, the thing is, often you write something and then the information comes through. So this person also showed me documentation and I said, oh, hang on, like your ComSec accounts that she's selling you to show you how brilliantly your shares are doing, they've only got six figures. A ComSec account has, your client number has eight figures. So I write this in my story and that single detail opened the floodgate. Then I get family members, cousins, friends saying, oh my God, I've now realised I'm a victim. I read your story. I rang up the Commonwealth Bank. I don't have a ComSec account. It has all been a fraud. And the thing that just struck me at the time was that her fraud was on the people nearest and dearest to her. Like, that is, you know, very unusual for that to happen. And then we're fast-forwarding now. So this all happened in November. Melissa Caddick has vanished. No one knows where she is. And then, of all things, her foot washes up.
It's so gruesome. That's such a gruesome detail.
I know. It's her foot washes up some 400 kilometres south of where she is presumed to have jumped off the cliffs at Dover Heights. And here's me thinking, right, that's the end of the mystery. But no, no, that just generated a whole new conspiracy that she'd chopped her foot off, that she had, you know, underworld figures, you know, cutting her leg off and planting it down on the south coast. So the weird thing about doing that story was you felt like you were in the middle of this extraordinary tale and even you did not know how it was going to end.
And how has it ended? Where has all of that story resolved for you?
It ended in the coroner did an inquest and there wasn't enough remains of the foot to tell how it had come separated from the body. But they had really interesting oceanographers giving evidence that with the tidal flows along the east coast of Australia, it was possible for a shoe to go that far. And also there was this fascinating case in British Columbia, and it was the case of the 21 feet. So 21 feet had washed up near Vancouver. And at first they thought that there was a serial killer on the loose, but they found that they were different shoes. And it turned out the inquest there showed that with the advent of the modern running shoe, its buoyancy and its synthetic fibres don't break down as much. These shoes, like, and these were from people who'd suffered misadventures. They'd fallen into the water or they'd fallen off bridges and things like that.
And these shoes are just circulating in the oceans.
Yes, that they'd washed up along the coast because of tidal flows. And it's like, I cannot believe the things that I have learned from a missing fraudster, things I never thought I would know about decomposition of ankle bones, etc.
You know, there are these remarkable facts and comic elements almost in that story in particular. But at the same time, as you acknowledge, these real ordinary people had discovered that their lives were ruined by this woman's crimes.
Ruined.
What kind of impact did their stories and your meeting with those victims have on
look,
you?
It's now been 5 years and I still catch up with those people. I still talk to them about the impact it's had on their lives. And
as a journalist or as a...
Well, both really, because I find that one of the things that you do in your life as a journalist is that I don't want to say we use people because I try not to do that, but for a period of time, these people give you their all. They give you all their information. They give you their heartbreak, what's happened to them. And I never want them to feel that didn't matter. So you find that you talk to them, just keep them involved in what's happening every now and then down the track, years down the track, you send them a funny, look what I just found or something like that. Because I just think it's important for people to feel that they matter, that their stories matter. And even if that story has long passed, you appreciated what they did. And I just think this one person, Kate Horn, who was one of Melissa's friends, you know, she was a single mother struggling. And her friend had all the trappings of wealth. Little did her victims know she was running a Ponzi scheme and she'd stolen more than $30 million. They think, oh, she's really successful. So when Melissa said to them, listen, Sarah, I do this as a living. Give me your money. I'll invest it for you. And every month she would send you a ComSec account saying, look at the investments I've done. They are having a remarkable return. And you go, wow. And I can remember Kate Horn saying, I just looked at Melissa and I said, Melissa, I can't thank you enough for all the things that you do for me. And Melissa looked at her right back and said, that's what I'm here for. And meanwhile, she's going skiing to Aspen, flying first class, buying an endless array of designer handbags and luxury clothes. I just find it unfathomable that you could do that to the people you love.
This sense of justice that you have of it's just wrong what people are doing wrong, that must be a big part of the motivation for you.
Look, it is. And as a journalist, we do have the ability to be a voice for the voiceless.
As a result of these investigations, you're often in court looking face to face at someone who's there because of your reporting. What's that like? What's it like to turn up to court and see the person that you've been writing about face the consequences of their crimes?
More often than not, they or their family will turn and give you the most filthy looks, like, you know, if they could jump out of their seat and kill you, they would. And you think, I am sorry, I didn't do these crimes. You did. Like, I am just reporting them. It never ceases to amaze me how people will blame the bringer of bad tidings rather than the perpetrator. And I was at a coffee shop and this woman came up to me and said, you, it's your fault. You know, what you did to my husband is just a disgrace. And everyone is dead silent and listening. And I said, oh, and where is your husband now? Jail. That's right. And then I just beat a hasty retreat.
You mentioned earlier the fact that you've received serious threats and your family have received threats out of the work that you do, because often you're going after people who've got very significant connections in criminal gangs and organised crime and other individuals. How do you know which threats to take seriously?
Look, it's hard to know. I remember writing about a Cremorne businessman, Michael McGurk, who had told me that he was going to be murdered. And he said, these are the people that are going to have me murdered, Ron Medich and Lucky Gattalari. And you can imagine my shock and horror when 6 days later he's in fact shot dead in front of his 9-year-old son. So I am reporting on this and I get a letter in my letterbox at home calling me a lying slut and to stop writing about this, or I think it was I'd see a point 303. And I remember saying to my husband, because 303 was our street number, and I said, well, they've put a letter in our box. They know that 303 is our street number. And he said, no, a point 303, it's a rifle. It's a, and I said, oh, right, okay.
Okay.
So, you know, I gave that to the police and, look, I never found out who wrote it, but I remember the words of one of my police contacts saying to me, Kate, look, it's the ones that don't threaten you are the ones that you should worry about.
Oh, that's not reassuring.
I know. But if you do get death threats like that, it's more likely they just want you to stop what you were doing. If they really wanted to stop you, there are other things that they could do that are more serious. And you just think, it's true. If somebody wanted to do something, they could do it. But I always think it would be very bad for business. But I often joke with my family about, oh, but I worry about how many suspects that there would be. How could they pin down?
It would be the trial of the century. But have there been times where you've had to get security or move out of your house?
Well, yes. I can remember doing the Bulldogs salary cap scandal. Like, this was back in 2002, I think it was. And I got a call from the police saying, look, we've got credible threats. so you need to move out of your house. But the thing that sticks with me the most then was, I'm sorry, you know, hang at work, you know, I've got young children, family. And I said, oh, look, can we go to the Sir Stamford? And they said, no, it's not in our budget. I said, okay, what about the Medina Apartments? No, not in the budget. So I end up, our family ends up at these dreadful apartments next to the cinemas in George Street. And there were bottle tops under the bed. It was that kind of place. So then I actually thought I'd actually rather die than spend one more night here. So then we had for a little while, we had guards outside the house.
And with the cat, how did your children react? What did you do to try to shield them from all that?
Isn't this exciting? We're on a holiday. Look, if you keep a positive outlook, your children, you know, they think it's all, you know, like you would never say or let on that you were frightened. Like you would never do that.
I mean, you did say that, of course, you'd been concerned about them when they were younger, but there was an incident where you used your own children as cover to attend a mafia meeting. Is this true, Kate McConnell?
Yes, sadly that is, yes. yes, so there was going to be a big mafia meeting and I said to my sister-in-law was down from Orange and I said, look, we're going to go for a pizza. It's going to be really good fun. And we get there and I said, now, we've got to see that table over there. We need some photos of that. And she said, what? You're kidding me. I said, oh, look, they'll never suspect children. So, you know, or getting the children to go over there and said, now, just take the photos. Just walk past casually. Worked a treat, I have to say.
What did your kids think of this?
I thought it was great. They didn't know. They had a very important job to do and they were very pleased to have done it well.
Over your four decades as a journalist, you have made mistakes, would be, I would think, inevitable for anyone, including a naming error in your book about Eddie Obeid. What were those moments like when you realised that despite all of your work and attention?
A common name and the wrong person. Oh, look, any journalist who says that they never make a mistake, impossible. And the thing about making a mistake is you have to acknowledge it swiftly, quickly, and say, yes, it was a mistake, and try to rectify it. And look, one of the other most ridiculous mistakes I did was covering the inquest into the death of Caroline Byrne. A jury initially found that her boyfriend, Gordon Wood, had thrown her off a cliff, but it was overturned on appeal. Anyway, so I had accidentally put that the scientific evidence was that she had travelled to land where she did. She had travelled at so many kilometres per second. So readers contacted me and said she would be on the moon if she was travelling at so many kilometres per second. And it was metres per second. No one to blame but myself. And in those days we actually had check subs and they didn't pick it up either. But honestly, it is...
I mean, you can be philosophical about it, but it must feel...
Oh, it's terrible.
You must want to throw up when you realise it's happened.
It is terrible. It is like, oh, really? And the errors are usually silly.
It's not the core of the story that you're working on, but it can...
No. It's usually not a major part of the story. It's some minor part of the story and... Like, who wants to have a correction saying, you know, we've slipped up, but, you know, we're human and we do it.
And how do you pick yourself up after something like that?
Oh, look, I think probably the worst thing that happened to me in my career was being successfully sued by Eddie Obeid. And he basically sued for suggesting that he was corrupt. And he was awarded $150,000. Plus his costs. And I remember thinking my reputation as a journalist is ruined. I can't ever write about Eddie Obeid again. To me, that was just the most momentously horrendous moment in my career. And then it lasted for about 6 months. And then I just thought, oh, look, okay, just dust yourself off. Keep going. And then guess what? Eddie Obeid, as a result of my investigations, there was an ICAC inquiry. He's ended up in jail. not once, not twice, but he's now, he'll be out in August and then next year he's slated to have a third trial.
That helped, did it, Phil? Assuage that feeling?
When he went to jail for the first time, I was standing in the newsroom watching as it happened and I wept like it had been the most stressful thing, like apart from the lawsuit, you know, one of his sons-in-laws had gone to punch me in the face outside an ICAC inquiry and a reporter from The Australian stepped in and stopped him. I had private investigators following me, trying to find dirt on me. They'd even set up a fake website that had a photo of me with tape over my face and saying that I'd done all these lies. And, of course, I never Google my name, so I didn't know it was there. So then they had to send me a photo of the website, but their fingerprints were on the fingerprints were on the envelope. So I sort of felt it took an enormous toll.
Have there ever been points in this long career that you thought, you know, time to step away or it's not worth it?
Yes, yes. Look, every now and then when things like that happen, it's hard to explain the stress of, you know, uncovering things like, you know, sexual abuse or corruption. You know what's coming your way. You know that people are going to master their supporters or there'll be a campaign to discredit what you have done. And every now and then you think, is this worth it? And then you think, yes, it is. It is absolutely worth it.
Well, when we were just chatting before we came in, Kate, you were telling me about how many calls are happening already this morning, what stories you're following at the moment. It seems like your work is as exciting to you as it has always been.
Look, almost every single day I think to myself, how lucky am I to do a job that I absolutely love? Not all the time, but most days you think it's an absolute privilege to do this kind of work.
Kate, the country is lucky to have you. Thank you so much for being my guest on Conversations.
It's been my pleasure, Sarah. Thank you.
I spoke with Kate McClymont in 2025. This episode of Conversations was produced by Alice Moldovan and recorded on the lands of the Gadigal peoples. Our executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.